Thanks for listening to the Roman Circus Podcast. I'm Matt Baker, and with me, as always, is Zach Mabry. Zach, how are you, my friend?
Matt, I'm doing good. It's hot, but you know, I'm surviving, making it work.
Classic August activity. If you want to find us on Twitter, you can find us at Roman Circus Pod. I'm at Hey, It's Matt Baker. Zach is at Zach Mabry, Z-A-C Mabry. I'm going to do a blue sky. I need to do a blue sky for the podcast so we can be all up in there when Elon eventually just makes you pay for everything.
I still think that Twitter, or X, I guess, is here to stay.
I know. I don't think it's going. I just think he just says whatever he's thinking at that moment.
And it's like Who Among Us, you know?
Exactly. Zach, we're doing a podcast. I'm not going to like tell Elon he's wrong for talking, right? How dare the people who speak in the microphone tell the richest person in the world what to do?
Is he number one?
Number one in my heart. I don't know about the rankings.
The official stats.
I can effort that. Google, I'll type in richest person in the world, and I wonder if that'll bring that up. It says Elon Musk, CEO of Twitter and SpaceX, or CEO of Tesla.
Well, there you go.
Forbes has a real-time billionaires list, which is the most Forbes thing I can possibly think of. Some dude named Hubert Berta gained $291 million today, and some chump named Jung Yang G lost $1 billion. Imagine losing $1 billion in a day. What a loser.
I really think the true rich, in reality, I think the richest person is just the person listening to this podcast.
It's so true. Bill Gates is sixth. You really got to wonder why he's failed so hard to move down to six.
But it's still Elon Musk. Probably a diet made up of PUFAs and seed oils, because if you look at him, he looks sickly.
Yeah, exactly. Elon Musk, $10 billion richer than second place Bernard Arnault and family. I like that he put his family in there, too.
Bernard. Oh, Bernard.
The real one of the top 10 that's just living his best life is Steve Ballmer, because he has almost $100 billion, and he owns the Clippers, and he's just out there doing things. He doesn't have to worry about anything else.
I like that.
If you're a billionaire listening to this, we will sell out to you.
Whatever you want.
Billionaires are amazing. If you want to give us a bunch of money.
Yeah, we will shill for whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Right now we shill for poor people because that's what we are, right? But as we write up the ranks, we'll adjust accordingly.
Yeah, and keep refreshing that Forbes live tracker to see if I'm going to show up. But so far,
yeah. Well, we'll update by the end of the podcast. In the news, Zach, unfortunately, one of the podcast favorites is back in the news for a sad situation. Why don't you update us on our gal B. Spears?
Well, it seems that the fairy tale is ending, and Sam Asghari has filed for a divorce from Britney Spears.
Right.
Nobody saw that coming, so everyone's very shocked.
Very shocked and confused. Now, if longtime listeners remember, our last podcast we did before we came back was about Britney Spears saying she was going to be Catholic. We didn't do any updates on that over the 2 years. So do we have any Britney Spears' Catholic updates? Didn't she kidding?
Well, it's possible she's in an extremely long RCIA program. Barring that, it doesn't seem like she went through with it. It did kind of, it did seem like a joke, but it was fun when it happened.
Hey, it got us to podcast, and then we went away.
So the funny thing with like the Britney marriage, so they met on the set of one of her music videos. So there was always this sort of doubt about him from most of her fans, because she was hired, he was hired by basically the conservators during that time period. And so they never really trusted him because that's how they met. So there's not a lot of people that are too broken up about it among her fans.
Interesting. Now,
he has reportedly threatened to release embarrassing information about her if...
Oh, no. Embarrassing information about Britney Spears, Zach?
I know.
The world would not know what to do with that.
I know. And, so he has threatened to do that if the prenup that they entered into before the marriage, if it's not renegotiated so that he can get some money.
And got it.
Then there's rumors that she was unfaithful, which, I mean, I don't support being unfaithful, but, you know, you've been locked in your house for 13 years. You probably got to, you know, let your freak flag fly for a little bit, right? Like, you know, make up for lost time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, you know, you hate, to, I don't really know what happens to him after this. He's literally only known as her partner, like her husband slash when they were just boyfriend, girlfriend. And, you know, the parts and stuff that he got were mostly because of her. So I don't know what happens to him after this, but.
Sorry. All I can think about since you talked about Britney Spears and a flag is adding Britney Spears to the LGBTQ flag.
That's the B.
Oh, that is the
That's the B that actually exists.
Yeah. that's the real B in LGBTQ.
Yes. Yeah.
They met and started dating when he was on set for her music video for her song Slumber Party, Zach. A song she wrote when she was 37 years old.
Well, that's normal.
Mm-hmm.
And wait, that doesn't sound right.
She began dating Slumber Party's music video co-star Sam Asghari after the two met on set. And then in April, the Israeli Labor Party announced that it would reschedule its July primary election to avoid conflict with Spears' sold-out Tel Aviv concert. So she got Israel to completely postpone an election for her.
I mean, is that pro-democracy? Is that anti? I don't even know what that counts as. Going to postpone the election? So, like, a lot of people have had a lot to say about her situation since the conservatorship ended. People are like, oh, it was a mistake. She needs to be put back under it, blah, blah, blah. I think that's kind of, it's a little ridiculous if you're being serious. In a conservatorship, you know, whether it's of the person or of the estate, you don't get to make any of your own choices, or at a minimum, they all have to be cleared through some other person legally.
Right.
I don't think dancing around your house all crazy rises to the level of something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it's not living your best life by any normal standard, but I don't think that you put people under a conservatorship for not living their best life. Like it to me, it's a bit extreme to look at any of her behavior and be like, oh, this requires court intervention.
They go in front of a judge and they're like, why do you bring this case to me? And they're like, Your Honor, she's been attempting to live her best life.
Or she, yeah, like, yeah, she hasn't been.
This is very concerning.
Yeah. I mean, I just think, again, dancing around your house and being weird and writing weird Instagram captions isn't really a matter that concerns the courts or requires state involvement, I would say. And
so, yeah, so she, KFED, Kevin Federline, is still the top tier Britney Spears husband right now, checking in at 3 years. So,
oh, that was the longest of the three. Those, yeah. I guess, yeah. And so then Sam comes in at two.
Yeah, because she had one in 2004 annulled. I'd completely kind of forgotten about that.
Oh yeah, that was the big. That was the big scandal because it was 55 hours and basically they were all out in Vegas partying and they're like, want to get married? Sure. And then word reaches somebody and like immediately her management and family and like everybody descends on Las Vegas to get it annulled and get everything back to normal.
The marriage was annulled 55 hours later following a petition to the court that stated that Spears lacked understanding of her actions. So that's a refrain that would pop up many times over the following years.
Yeah. Well, and that guy actually showed up at her marriage to Sam, like tried to break in or something. It was a whole ordeal. So he's not actually out of the picture. Maybe they'll finally end up together.
That would be, you know, that would be the real Cinderella story of this situation.
Yeah. But no, I mean, he seems like a gold digger and kind of like a hanger on. So I think she's probably better off after this, you know,
gold digger.
Yeah.
What's the second line of that refrain, Zach?
I don't remember.
Okay. Okay.
After Kanye's shocking statements, I've purged all of that from my mind.
Yeah.
In solidarity.
Yeah.
So we wish you the best, Brittany, and you know, get through this divorce. Don't give him a penny. Who cares what he says? It's pretty much all out there anyway, so there's no need to save face.
And, yeah, what does he have? What could he possibly have on her?
There's all sorts of rumors that like she really, really does not like showering and will, you know, have like body odor and stuff. That's the thing. I'm like, it's all probably out there to one degree or another. It just doesn't get picked up in major news sources. And you know, if he says it, it's going to be all over TMZ. But I don't really know what it could be. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, she's a little bit out there, right? Like that's all part of it. It just was never to anybody's, you know, it wasn't reasonable to be under legal constraints, but she's weird. She's weird. Like she's very weird. And she does the videos and goes on her vacations. But at the end of the day, I think I read somewhere she makes about $10 million a year when she's not working, just in terms of like
residuals and stuff,
royalties and residuals and
yeah,
stuff like that. And she goes on all these vacations, but it's to like Cabo and so, like she's not spending even the amount of money she has coming in. So there's really nothing to be concerned about. I think people maybe thought, oh, she's going to be out of this and she's going to be just like back in the early 2000s. And she was,
yeah.
She hasn't wanted to do that since 2005. Like she hasn't ever wanted to be, you know, that level of superstar at any point since then. And I mean, then they basically had to use her kids to kind of get her to do tours after the conservatorship and like, oh, you can have custody if you just go on tour to promote the circus album, blah, blah, blah. She doesn't
just do 70 dates in Vegas over 30 days and you can see your kids.
Yeah. And I mean, so she's not ever going to be doing, I mean, she doesn't like it. Like at the end of the day, it either because she's already done it and it's boring or because she's older and that stuff's tiring or just bad memories from how it all went down. There's never going to be a point where she comes back out and wants to start doing a bunch of music and promoting it everywhere and being, you know, number one. That's not there. She likes to go. It looks like she likes to go on vacation to sort of basic places like Hawaii and Mexico and dance around her living room, you know, and that doesn't really, that's not a danger to anyone. So, you know, wishing her the best. Hope it
literally
all goes
well. Everyone that goes on vacation in Mexico or Hawaii and posts on Instagram.
Well, that's what I said. A lot of these people have, I mean, you see, people have the most dysfunctional lives and like everything is a mess. And then they see her and they're like, oh, she needs, you know, legal intervention. It doesn't make sense. So, you know, yeah. What else is in the news?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what else is. There was the big hubbub about, we've had a lot of music in the news because they've had the Jason Aldean song and then this week, the Rich Man North of Richmond song. And then also,
so the Jason Aldean song, that's the Try It in a Small Town song.
Yeah. Which I listened to and it's basically just like every other country song. It, you know, it literally just, I don't know.
I tried it in a small town. I tried it in a small town once, and the resident said, "What did you say?" And then said, "By the way, do you know where I can get more fentanyl?" I don't know. Small towns are pretty dysfunctional. So that's where I feel like if you visit one, it does seem like a place you could actually get away with kind of a lot, but,
and then I didn't actually listen to the Richmond north of Richmond because I don't know. I honestly just didn't want to for no other reason than like, whatever.
I listened to it. It's not really my style of song.
Yeah.
But it, you know, a clever hook with the Richmond north of Richmond, as in politicians in Washington,
yeah,
DC, you know, neat. So I thought it was fine if you're into that kind of music, you know, talented lad, Oliver Anthony. But it was just too on the nose. It was too direct to the point. It didn't have room for like art, you know, there wasn't any subtlety to it. And so it felt like a campaign ad. Now, a lot of people's reaction to it though, I didn't want to be on the side of the people who were against it because it was clear to them. They just have this like aesthetic aversion to just like people from West Virginia or wherever this person's from.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, I mean, I thought it was fine. I noticed it got a positive review from Word on Fire.
Okay.
For speaking to the common working man. So, and I don't know. I don't know a lot of common working men, so I'll have to find
good them. Good, that's the stuff we need to say to be real-time vaulted onto the Forbes billionaires list, so keep saying things like that.
Right. Well, so I mean the song was fine, it just was odd. I mean, then I don't think it was anything groundbreaking, and I also don't think it was anything offensive, and there were people that were acting like it was this huge offensive song demonizing the poor and whatnot. And I mean, yeah, the second verse talks about people buying snacks and stuff on food stamps, and I think that's a stupid thing to waste energy on. Our budget for things like SNAP, which is food stamps, and TAMP, which is the cash welfare type thing, it's not a very big portion of overall spending. There's a lot more concerning things that money goes to. You know, I mean, I would just tell somebody in a normal conversation, like, it's really not the food stamps thing that's eating up your taxes. So, you know, but I mean, that's normie stuff. The other charge that I saw, and I mean, this could be true, I don't know, is that it's pretty much just this kind of astroturfed industry plant thing that's backed by like conservative orgs.
Like, so like
basically
somebody,
Daily Wire, and
somebody just wrote the song and paid this guy to sing it.
Yeah, or they found the guy and then they've helped promote it and make sure that it went viral and whatnot. I mean, but you see that, right? Like, Cardi B is an industry plant, Jennifer Lopez is an industry plant, a lot of people are industry plants, and they make songs that people like. So I mean, it would be weird if suddenly the Daily Wire or the GOP or something was inserting celebrities into the galaxy of stars. But it's fairly normal for a famous person to have had backing from some kind of, you know, in some kind of institutional backing to make sure that their stuff gets out there. So, I mean, that doesn't really change anything. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. I think it was odd to have such strong opinions about it. It's just a regular song that you could like and sing along to or not like and not listen to it. It isn't groundbreaking as far as speaking to the everyday, you know, the everyman's plight. And it's also not some sort of diatribe against poor people or anything. It's just a song. It can't hurt you.
Where is this song right now? Is this song in the room with us right now? People have to have opinions about every single thing, and it's not groundbreaking, but the song that did come out this weekend, that was groundbreaking, Zach.
Oh yes.
Planet of the Bass.
Planet of the Bass.
Truly an internet moment, if there ever was one. A few weeks ago, a fella named Kyle Gordon, who does videos on YouTube, put out a video about like what every 1990s Euro pop song sounds like. And it was really good. And it really captured like the beat and the vocals and everything about this, like what that genre was like, right?
Yes.
And then they came out with the full song and full video for it. And it was like, it just, it went over really well. And the comments were great. And one comment was like, I didn't know I could be nostalgic for things that happened 2 weeks ago. But like, it was so true. And then the Jonas Brothers did a concert. I don't know. I assume it was New York. I don't actually know where it was. But and they brought these two out on stage to do this fake like Euro pop song in front of everybody. And it was...
Well, it's not fake anymore.
Well, no, sorry. Like they're fake Euro pop people. Like they're Americans.
Oh, yeah. They're playing. Americans.
Yeah. So like they brought him out to do the song. And the video is so great because... The girl who's taking it is freaking out because she loves it. But then you can just see that there are people who like it and there are just a bunch of people who are just like, what am I watching right now? The ones who aren't like terminally online just have no idea what they're actually taking in.
If you ever played DDR, Dance Dance Revolution, all the songs for that were basically these Euro dance numbers and it just felt like one of those. Mm-hmm. It was fun. I remember when the video... It was like a TikTok. The joke comes out that, you know, all 90s, whatever. I kept retweeting. It was like, I can't stop listening to this. You know, the lyrics are sort of, you know, they don't make sense. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's some guy that's doing kind of his white guy rap thing. And then a blonde girl singing her parts. And I don't know. It's good. And I was very happy for them. It was a true kind of... You know, you're a basketball person. What do they call these? A Cinderella story? Is that applicable here?
I guess a Cinderella story is just like a small college beats a big college type thing. So this is just more of a like Kyle Gordon just found something and it just hit and it went like a lightning in a bottle, maybe.
Now, what will probably happen is that he'll try to do more and it won't go over well. So we should just really, I think everyone needs to celebrate Planet of the Bass and listen to it and put it on your playlists. And then, you know, I would just not have a lot of high expectations. And I mean, obviously if you have a song that's a hit, you need to have a second song,
right?
Or at least try. And then it flops and you move on with your life. It's fine. Like this. No, it was fun. I was excited to see that the Joe Bros, I didn't know they were back. So I'm glad that Kyle Gordon was helping promote the Joe Bros.
Exactly. They need all the help.
What I first saw about them, about their tour, was everyone saying that they were ripping off the Taylor Swift Eras tour because mm-hmm. they have like an encore at the end where it seems like the show's over, but surprise, they're doing another song.
And yeah, Taylor Swift invented the touring, Zach.
Yeah, it's one of those where, like, I guess if that's your only touch point for music, maybe you didn't know about encores, and maybe you didn't know about standard touring things and using videos. And but I don't think they were copying anything. I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, they're playing their show in all these different cities, and they're selling tickets to them exactly like Taylor Swift.
Yeah, how dare they? Taylor Swift played State Farm Stadium in Glendale, Arizona. How dare other people rip off her idea of doing that?
Yeah, it's, where have I seen this before?
This transition only works if you ignore the last few minutes of music talk we just did. But speaking of conservatorships, Zach, the big news this week. Well, you know.
A story that really made a splash.
Yeah. I don't know if it's big news. The big news that the government wants you to know about to distract you is that Michael Orr, he was the secondary character in his own life story, The Blind Side, that came out in 2009. And he claims that the Tui family that adopted him never actually adopted him, just had him in a conservatorship that was still in effect and that resulted in him basically getting paid nothing for his life story.
Yeah. So the conservatorship, right, he announces, and I didn't know this, I don't think this was commonly known, I mean, who knows, that he is still under a conservatorship of with the TUIs, and that he was told, basically that he was told that entering a conservatorship, because he was 18, he was a, you know, a legal adult at the time in Tennessee, that that would make him part of the TUI family, and it was necessary for this and that to happen. And he's only, he learned in February of this year that a conservatorship doesn't establish a familial relationship, and he's actually not legally part of their family. And he feels betrayed. He's wanting to, he sued to have the conservatorship terminated, and I believe he also wants damages from the TUIs in terms of lost money for the movie and other projects that went on. So this obviously shot to the top of people's consciousness, because obviously conservatorships have been in the limelight since the Britney thing, and that word becoming something most people see, that word becoming kind of a word people know. And then the movie was extremely famous. It's been reevaluated since prior to this incident, but the, you know, the movie was everywhere. And yeah, so now it's okay. Are the TUIs, are they bad guys? Did they hustle him? You know, what's happening here?
So, so basically the TUI family released a statement claiming that Michael Orr had tried to threaten them with a shakedown for money in the past. And as of yesterday, the TUIs are actually looking to end the conservatorship.
Yeah, I mean, to that though, it's pretty normal prior to a lawsuit to ask for money. You know, I mean, that's typically what happens before a lawsuit, is you try to handle it directly, right? So, I mean, the shakedown thing, it that doesn't undermine the lawsuit in, to me, because obviously if you believe that you're owed something, you should ask first and then sue later, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, well, why don't we, let's kind of go through this, break it down, starting with the movie.
Yeah, so I had never seen the movie, and I had watched it last night. I watched it last night, and Zach rewatched it last night, this morning as well. So what I wanted to do, Zach, is I wrote down a bunch of notes, and I'll take us through the movie, and you also comment where you feel is necessary, okay? Which can be after every single thing if you want.
Sure. Sounds
there's
good.
There's no limits. I'm not rate limiting your ability to reply to me.
Right. Fair.
Let me get my first note up, because it's a note that is not on my paper, but it's a note I sent to you.
It's a note in your mind.
Yeah.
Well, while you're doing that, just as an overview, the movie was very famous. It was nominated for Best Picture. Sandra Bullock won the Academy Award for Best Actress for her role playing Leanne Tui. Like, this was like the movie. I mean, it didn't win Best Picture, and there were, but it was a huge splash. And
it's important to note that we're not dragging Sandra Bullock into this.
Never.
She's golden in our eyes, and she. There's no reason to bring Sandra Bullock in.
Funny. That was actually one of the funniest reactions. People wanted a statement from Sandra Bullock. It's like, do you understand that she was an actress in the movie and was just reading lines?
Yeah, she literally got the script and was like, oh, I like the cut of this woman's jib, and decided to do it.
And she did great. I know we're going to get to that, but having rewatched it, it was different from a lot of the Sandra Bullock roles that you see.
Yeah.
And I think that she did a great job playing this character, and
she's great in it.
Awards that she won off of it. And, you know, blonde Sandra Bullock is something new and unique, and yeah, good for her.
She's great in it, Zach, and .. That's a problem, but we'll get to that. Basically, the first thing I thought when I started watching this movie is, it's hilarious. And the tagline should have been, Southern Christian mother extraordinaire saves Michael, the poor retarded black boy, to the max. It has all the subtlety.
They went like way over the top trying to make him seem dumb. Like, they made him seem like he was, you know, mute or in so I don't remember the term, but like nonverbal.
He's a big dumb oaf. Okay.
In the movie. Yeah.
He like walks around like he's dumb and he walks around like an oaf and he walks around. They're like, can you walk like a poor dumb person would walk? And he's like, do they walk like this? And he's like, yeah, that seems like a good way.
Yeah, he takes that test at the beginning, and all he does is put his name on it, and then he draws a picture of a sailboat.
Draws a picture of a sailboat, and then he just goes, can I leave now? And so they're all just like, well, we have this big, big fella. I don't know if he should come into school. And they're like, you see that? You see that on the wall? That says Christian, and we're Christians, and we have to let him into this school. And they're just like, well, okay. And so he goes to the school and he has nowhere to stay and he's just kind of lumbering around like a big dumb oaf would. And then they go to a volleyball game. And my note for that is, hey, it's Lily Collins. Hey, Lily Collins' name is Collins. So,
oh, that's interesting. The actress. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that was funny because, again, with the admissions thing and this guy, they're arguing about to let him in the school and we have to because it says Christian and they say he's got an 80 IQ in his GPA. But the reality is that Michael Orr got into the private school on the basis of academics and that was not something that he needed. I mean, you know, everybody needs teachers. That's why you go to school. But he was not intellectually delayed and he was. I mean, it wasn't reality. He got in on academic merit.
Like when we're first introduced to Leanne Tui, she's a powerful, strong woman. She is making moves and she is taking no guff. And this woman has made all the moves and taken none of the guff her entire life, Zach.
She's very much a Karen in that first scene where she's yelling into the phone about lazy boy recliners and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really think that this movie unlocked something dark inside of white women and been causing problems ever since. Like every Karen who chews out a waitress thinks that she's being Leanne Tui as depicted in The Blind Side.
So we'll get to that too. That's a good, I like that because we'll talk about that. I don't even remember what this, it just says, I have never done homework in my life, but then he says he's never done homework in his life, but then there's this thing where he has like a poem. So they try and set it up that he's this big dummy, but he also writes poetry and so powerful, strong Leanne Tui notices big dumb oaf, big Mike picking up trash in the bleachers after the volleyball game. And she doesn't approach him. It's just a look of like, well, that's interesting. That's something.
Is he eating the popcorn that he's picking up?
He might be.
What was that about?
Okay. I don't know. And then we cut to them drive, like him and, or Leanne Tui and Tim McGraw Tui are driving around with SJ, the little boy, and they see Big Mike walking on the side of the road. And he's like, where are you going? And they're like, going to the gym. And then they're like, all right, well, see you later. And they keep driving. And powerful, strong Leanne Tui goes, you stop this car right now. You turn around. And they're like, what? And she's like, this boy's coming home with us. I don't remember if that was the exact lines, but it was basically right?
Well, and like it's funny.
How dare you drive 10 feet? How dare you drive past this boy? He's coming home with us. And they're like, well, that's your mother. This is what your mother does. Sorry, what were you saying?
Well, one thing you see a lot in the movie, and Sandra Bullock does it well, is there's a whole bunch of times where there's not any action going on, but the idea is that her character Leanne is thinking and is about to make some sort of bold decision. So you see her kind
makes
like mentally
all the
chewing on something. And then, so she's like, and then she's like, stop the car. And then she gets out and she's talking to him and then she does it again. Like the movie has these pauses for Sandra Bullock's character to mentally chew on something and then make some sort of girl boss, you know, decision that no one questions immediately after. And it's pretty funny. I wish I had counted them. That could be a drinking game of like all of the thinking moments.
Which obviously leads to the point that we'll bring up, but we'll just say it now, is this is very clearly a Leanne Tui movie.
The movie's about Leanne Tui. Now, Leanne Tui only exists because of Michael Orr, but at the end of the day, the movie is about her and not
right. And it's Michael very Orr. Clearly about her. So they take Big Mike into their house and they do the classic. The Tuis are upstairs and Leanne's like, he's not going to steal anything, is he, or something? And Tim McGraw Tui is just like, well, I guess we'll find out in the morning. And guess what happens in the morning, Zach? She walks down the stairs and the couch he was sleeping on, all the blankets were perfectly folded up like a nice gentleman. And she's like, where did Big Mike go? And she goes outside and he's lumbering away like a big dumb oaf down the driveway. And she's like, come on.
With his luggage.
You get back here. You get back here right now.
Yeah.
I'm surprised she never. With him. Yeah. I'm surprised she never was like dropped like a go on, get one of those.
Well, there is that moment that, I mean, later in the movie, there is a go on, get type moment, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. So that, then it cuts to the classic. They're upstairs. They move him into a room and he's like, I've never had one of these before. And is a big dumb oaf would. And she says, what, a room? And he just says, a bed.
Which Michael Orr has specifically addressed that he did have a bed prior to living with the Tuis.
And that's the thing.
I mean, he didn't like the movie. And that's something that is that the relationship between the Tuis and Michael started breaking down after the movie because, and I mean, they didn't have creative control over it. But they don't seem to have ever tried to correct the way that it presented him as, again, being mute and dumb. And I mean, you know, things
so
that people
dumb.
Can be, but he isn't. Yes.
Why,
in the movie.
He's so dumb. And he's not. Yeah, that's, I would obviously like, how would you like this if you're Michael Orr? You wouldn't. And he didn't.
No.
But like the not having creative control thing, like that's all right. Maybe they didn't. But also like. It's a very specific decision to make Leanne Tui the main character. And
sure.
It's a very specific decision that the family definitely to some level agrees with.
Well, they never went out to correct it, right? They kept running with it because it was the basis of them becoming famous. Leanne is a motivational speaker and author. Mm-hmm. And in her book, she made some comment that, Michael would have, if it wasn't for her, Michael would have either been shot or he would be the bodyguard for a drug lord or a gang or something like that. And he's addressed that in his books that was hopefully a misquote because he was very determined and he was a talented athlete and he was intelligent. And he wasn't sure how to navigate things. And I mean, I don't know how you navigate becoming a college football player. I mean, I don't think that's something anyone would know. And when he meets the Tuis, they do take him in. He'd been in foster care and he'd been all over it. I mean, there was at the beginning in real life, it looks like a solid bond there, but
sure.
The fact that they kind of ran with the movie depiction of him and he didn't like the movie depiction of him probably set things up to fall apart the way they have now. The other weird trope in the movie is he's this sort of big, dumb, you know, guy who also fixes their family and kind of perfects it. So there's the scene right after he starts living with them where he has Thanksgiving dinner with the Tuis.
Right.
And they're all eating. It's very Talladega Nights. Like they're all just, you know, and they own Taco Bells and stuff. So, that you know, it's like they're all eating in front of the TV and whatever. He goes and sits at the table. I have no idea why. Like
they don't actually say why
because
they literally
portray
don't
him
why.
As having never had a functional background or household. So he was likely, mm-hmm. you know, the Michael Orr in the movie was not eating at the table prior to the Tuis, and then he just goes in and sits there. And then the shot in the movie when she, so, okay, goes back to Sandra Bullock. She sees him sitting there and you have another one of these paws for her to chew on it. And then she turns off the TV and everything moves to the dining room. There's a shot where Tim McGraw Tui is seated at the head of the table and she goes to put down the last of the plates after they moved. And it's the exact Norman Rockwell Freedom from Want photo. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where it's they set it up to look exactly
He look at that picture at one point too?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if that picture made it in, but it definitely was how that scene was shot. And because, I mean, especially the way that they're sitting at the table and she leans over Tim McGraw to put down the last platter. It's, you know, obviously was intentional. And that's, I mean, it's a weird trope. I don't know that it's necessarily offensive, but it's this odd thing that he's sort of healed their family by his presence. And
it's weird that this movie just does that. 'Cause this movie is so cheesy enough that I'm surprised they didn't insert a line where he's like, I've never eaten at a dining room table before, you know, like, or I've never eaten at a table before, even that, like, just, so.
And then they introduce him to the idea of football, or I guess you're going to get to this.
Oh, we'll get to that. So they, to celebrate that he gets into school, they go out to eat at a restaurant. And on the way there, he's just like, you own a lot of Taco Bells. Are we going to eat at one? You can eat there for free. And they're like, we sure can. He's like, well, why aren't we going there tonight? And they say, because we're going somewhere special. And they take him to a dining, like they take him to eat. And then this is another, what?
At Olive Garden.
Yeah. I don't know this is another, but another scene for Sandra Bullock to do, for Leanne Tui to do something powerful, strong, and then Tim McGraw Tui to say, that's your mother, you know, and give like a shrug. So then they have the dinner and they show the families outside and they show Michael Orr go up to another black fella in the restaurant who's working there and give him a, like the handshake hug thing. And it really plays like a, just two black dudes, you know, in this white town, just trying to make it as two black fellas. And they're like, who is
that? Notoriously white town of Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah. And they start going. And they say, who was that? And Big Mike says, that's Marcus. He's my brother. And that's it. That's the last we hear of that.
Oh, like, that's true. They never revisit the brother. It's just like, and I don't know if that was meant to highlight reversal of fortunes, like he's eating at the table and his brother's waiting the table.
But they say, like, when's the last time you saw him? Where does he live? And the answer is basically just, I don't know. And they're like, well, I guess that solves that. And then they just go, then like the movie just carries on. So we get to the part where he's enrolled in the school and now it's percolating through the school that the Tuies, that there's a big black fella living with a white family. And now we have to see how it goes over with everyone else. But we don't see how it goes over with anything in Tim McGraw's Tui's life. Cause the only thing Tim McGraw Tui does is own a bunch of Taco Bells. He's there to own Taco Bells and just say, that's your mother.
And in real life, the Tuies, they own, I think they've sold them by now, but with their fortune or what they did in business, they owned a lot of Taco Bells as well as KFCs and then Freddy's frozen custard, which is
Nice.
So
SJ, the son, he just loves it. Obviously he's a cute young kid who just loves life. And he's just like, you know,
yes. So very talented child actor. The quality of child actors has been bad and stays bad, but the kid they cast for SJ was good.
Yeah. So the only ones that it really affects are Lily Collins, and Leanne Tui. And it affects Collins because she just goes and sits with him in the library and her friends are like, Collins, what are you doing? And then it affects Leanne Tui because she has to go out to eat with the gals, the Southern gals lunch. And they're just like saying, you know, like whatever, I don't know, whatever they say. And at one point, one of them just says, Leanne, is this white guilt? Are you feeling white guilt? And I was just like, there, okay. At least we have the phrase white guilt pop up in this story. But because Leanne Toohey is powerful, strong, she's getting real frustrated with this, Zach. She's not loving the conversation. She's not loving the conversation at this lunch table. And I don't know where this fits in, forgive me, but there's the line, and the beginning of the line, someone says to Leanne, says, "You're changing that boy's life." And right in my mind, right away, I said, "No, he's changing mine." And after the Leanne Toohey paused to chew on it, she says, "No, he's changing mine."
So. Right. So that's obviously like the big line for the trailer. I'm sure if we pulled the tape at the Academy Awards when they announced the nominations, that was probably in the clip. Like,
I watched her acceptance speech, by the way.
You did? Okay.
Can talk about that. But
yeah, no, that was like the, I mean, I don't mind a cheesy line, but yeah, no, you changed his life. No, he's changing.
Yeah. So the thing where we can, when you talked about the Karen thing and this unlocks something in white women, like the scene at the lunch table was interesting to me because every white Southern Christian woman like that wants to be and thinks they're Leanne Toohey, but really they're probably just the other women at the lunch table. But it works so well because they all think they're Leanne Toohey. And they all want to be her, but also they don't have to want to be her because they all think they are her. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I mean, it's not even, I wouldn't say it's limited to Southern women. I think Leanne Toohey is like the perfect Sheryl Sandberg lean in kind of girl boss figure, you know?
Yeah. But I'm only saying white Southern Christian because this is how they were portrayed in the movie. So
yeah, in the movie for sure. Mm-hmm.
The country club
scene where, right, the, you know, he's changing mine, and then somebody offends her and she storms off after paying, of course, for everybody's meal.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Charge it to Taco Bell. Anyway. So, all right. So we get to the football, Zach, which, like, obviously, why are we here? We're here for the football. Big dumb oaf. They're basically like, this is the part that also I remember Michael Orr, real life Michael Orr, like, guys, I knew what football was. Like, I'm not stupid. I knew what football was. But obviously, he's the secondary character. So, you know, he has no real hero's journey, but his like kind of hero's journey is learning football, because at the end of the day, that's where his life went. But like, so obviously when you're big dumb oaf, they just stick you out there, Zach. They don't teach you a lick about football and they don't teach you anything. They just stick you out there.
She, yes.
They have,
she
they
goes
have
out
him.
And teaches him how to play football using a metaphor. And then,
yeah. So we'll, good. Yeah. So we'll get, yeah, that's, so that's the second, that's another football scene. This first one is he's just like picking up guys, grabbing him, doing all sorts of chaotic stuff. At one point, he's blocking, and he gets distracted by balloons. This is what I have in all caps. It's the biggest thing I wrote on my notes. He got distracted by balloons. The big dumb oaf just got distracted by balloons, Zach. Like, I don't know what... Every single thing is like... Obviously, Michael Orr hated this movie.
Well, yeah, because in the real life story, in the most positive light, is that he had a rough background, but he was determined, and he put his abilities and his talents to use. And then at the right moment, he came across this family that was able to open doors for him and help him turn his dreams into reality. And the movie makes him a character that has no agency. And like you said, no character development other than that he's like mute when it starts, and he can speak towards the end, but still kind of doesn't. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, he has no role in his success in the movie.
Yeah. His success, like he has no role in the success story of Leanne Tui. So then they cut to another scene. They're trying to get.
Is this when they're teaching him to play with like salt shakers or whatever?
Oh, there's that too. SJ does the best. Like, y'all put those players back in the spice drawer when you're done with them.
Yeah.
So that was good. They like teach him the salt shaker. I mean, that was like that. The problem. That's the thing is they're like
I guess if this had happened, it would be fine. Like if that were true, I guess.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, people can say it's irresponsible and the white savior thing, whatever. But like, this wasn't how it worked with him, and I could totally see being very offended, especially if also it's a celebrated movie, so everybody sees you and they think they know you, and they're kind of looking at it positively, but in their mind. You have no brain and you're just like a guy that a bunch of stuff happened to. And thank goodness the Taco Bell people saw you walking home in the rain and taught you how to read.
Set aside the rest of the movie, the scene where the SJ big Mike / Michael scenes are cute and like nice. That is that's a nice relationship.
This reminds me that I think the movie, I always saw it. I don't know if anyone else did. It was sort of intended as like the spiritual sequel to Remember the Titans because you have, it's a football movie, right? You've got the bossy blonde, though in this movie, it's Leanne Tui and the other one, it's Hayden the daughter.
Yeah.
So you have that, but then you also have a car crash scene. And
True. I didn't even think about that.
But so I think it was meant to capture that energy to an extent, except that this one was about just one of the, it wasn't actually about a team and it wasn't this black and white thing. I mean, there were blacks and whites in the movie, but it wasn't about any of the black characters other than, like you said, kind of the secondary, how was Leanne Tui's life being changed by Michael Orr? As they get to the movie.
So they get to, they get to like trying to adopt him or whatever. And at one point he just asks for a driver's license and they're like, why do you want to drive a car? And he says, I just want to hold something that has my name on it. Again, it's just like such a wah, wah moment, right? Like he very well might've said that, but it's just so overly this kid is poor and has nothing that all he wants is just something with his name on it.
Right.
Which I don't know. Maybe he did want it. So then we get to, the thing I put is the most realistic part of this is
when he gets in a car accident.
Yeah. The gentle giant, like the thing we're talking about how he plays this big dumb oaf, but these big high school kids, like just because they're big doesn't mean they're aggressive, right? So like they don't know what to do with their bodies. So the fact that he's kind of like doesn't know how to block or he's a little timid, like that's all very realistic.
Yeah, you see that with tall people in basketball. Like people would be tall and they have no hoops at all.
Yeah. So then we get to the second practice where again Big Mike is just donking around being a big oaf.
Did they get rid of the balloons at least?
they made the executive decision to pop those balloons. They didn't even let him pop them. Leanne Tui is just, she's powerful, strong, and she's going to make a decision. And that decision is to storm out onto the field. And she is going to teach Michael Orr how to block. Oh, sorry. The very first thing in the movie is a clip of Joe Theismann getting his leg broken by Lawrence Taylor. And it's a really gruesome injury and Joe Theismann's career ended, right? But the whole setup is a voiceover for Leanne Tui to talk about protecting the quarterback's blind side. And because Joe Theismann got his leg broken, that put a premium on left tackles, because the left tackle protects the quarterback's blind side. And because Joe Theismann broke his leg, that changed the family's fortunes forever.
In hindsight, I feel like that was not well developed. Like, I don't think that they really explained why it's called the blind side or why. To me, they didn't do a good job connecting that whole thing. Like, the idea was supposed to be that his role on the field was similar to either Leanne's role in his life or his role in their family life. But I don't think that they actually did a good job establishing that in hindsight.
See, so if you're listening and you don't know, the reason they call the left tackle the blind side is because a right-handed quarterback can see everything on his right, but he can't see the defenders on the left side, right? So you need someone really good to block for you on that side so you don't get your leg broken like Joe Theismann. So
that's why they had to call him Joe Theismann instead of Joe Legman.
Yeah, did you actually, Joe Theismann, it actually was Theismann, but because of the Heisman Trophy, he changed his name to Heisman to Theismann, so it rhymed with Heisman. And I don't think he won it, but he just kept the name. So that's an aside. And so she storms out onto the field, and she teaches Michael Orr how to play football in 5 seconds by saying, "That's the quarterback. That's me." Right? So she puts herself as the quarterback, which is the most important, arguably, person on the field. And she's like, "You protect me just like you protected me when we went to the hood." And then she's like, "See this Oompa Loompa? That's SJ. You protect SJ." And then Big Mike says, "Well, what about Tim McGraw, Tui, and Collins?" And she's like, "Sure, they're on the team also." And which is perfect for the movie because they're like, yeah, they're also in the movie. And she just says, like, "You protect the family. This is the family. Protect the family."
And yeah, so she gives him a metaphor, which makes him suddenly an athlete and good at football.
So, right. Which Zach, ironically enough, when Big Mike, who's established that he doesn't like to be called Big Mike by now, he just likes Michael.
In the movie or IRL?
Well, in the movie.
Okay. That flew over my head. Got it.
Yeah. When Michael took a test, like an aptitude test, he was real dumb in everything, Zach, except he tested 98% in protective instincts. 98% in protective instincts, Zach, which is like, it's almost 100%, and it's in protective instincts, which you need as a lineman to protect the family. What are the odds?
That actually reminds me. So he's not a good student in the movie, and then he can't do his tests. Mm-hmm. So then they figure out if they give him the tests orally, and they ask him the questions and he just answers back, that he's suddenly good at it. But also he writes poetry, so he is good at writing. Like, again, that's where the movie it doesn't hold up to examination when you look at some of these narratives of like, their way of making him dumb is all kind of confusing and conflicting. And because, right, he can only take tests if it's done out loud, because he must not be able to write. But also, he wrote this poem about his life.
Yeah.
And that means, so yeah, no, it's all over the place.
He's real dumb, but he's not that dumb. So we get to his first game, Zach. This is the first game. This is the big moment. They go, the Tuies. Is Collins a cheerleader? Collins just wasn't in this scene?
Yeah, because I think in real life, she actually went on to be an Ole Miss cheerleader, which has got to be depressing.
Okay. So they go and they sit down, and they are a bunch of white people in a sea of white people, but they're in enemy territory. And Leanne Tui says, "You ever see so many rednecks in one place?" And SJ, the son, says, "NASCAR. Not even close," which is another thing about this movie, is pretty much all the jokes in this movie are like, we asked AI to write us jokes to put in this movie. Like, they sound like jokes sound, and they have cadence of how jokes are, but they're not actually jokes.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I part of me thinks that in a way this movie is, it's sort of like if Remember the Titans and Talladega Nights had a baby. And the baby wanted to speak to the manager.
Yeah. That's good. So it's going just as you'd imagine it would go, Zach. Michael is just having a heck of a time with number 66 out there, who's hooting and hollering and getting passed and sacking the quarterback. And then the most devastating thing that can happen happens. The other team scores a touchdown and they're down 6-0. Like in all sports movies, I just love, because they don't focus on the sports or they don't try and make the sports super relevant. Like they're like, well, they just scored a touchdown in the first quarter and just, this is super devastating right now. Right. Like, which is like objectively not a super devastating thing. It's just a touchdown happened in the first quarter of a game, but it riles everyone up. And Michael is just big oafing around. Leanne Tui, oh, the coach, his cell phone starts ringing, Zach, on the sidelines. And who is it? It's old Leanne Tui calling the coach on the sidelines.
And he hears that from the sidelines.
A thing that
he answers
would never happen. All these just multiple things that aren't even like close to the realm of reality.
But she girl bosses her way through that scene.
She girl bosses her way through the scene, tells him to get it together. It's just like, get it together. And he's just like, he hangs up and she's like, he hung up on me. And Tim McGraw-Tui steps in to just go, I think he lost service. And she's like, ah, he didn't lose service. So what happens is they still kind of get kicked around, but then the coach gets real upset and the coach gets a flag on, there's a flag on the coach for, I don't know, unsportsmanlike conduct or something. And the coach is giving the ref the business and he says, like, that's my player and I'm going to do whatever it takes to protect my player. And old big dumb dummy is standing there, but then he kicks, 98% protective instinct mode kicks in and he saves the coach from the referee's bombardment. And he's like, calm down, coach, I got this, right? So he's using that 98% protective instinct. And he goes out there, and wouldn't you know it, turns it right around. The next play, he grabs old 6, he's throwing 66 around, grabs old 66 by the shoulder pads, and just starts running him back down the field. And the good team scores a touchdown, and Michael keeps running 66 out of the field and just dumps him over the fence. He blocks him like 80 yards down the field, which that sets up for the scene where I gave a genuine laugh. All right. I don't know if you genuinely laughed at anything in the movie.
There's parts. Oh yeah. It's a charming, despite all what we're saying, it's still, the movie is kind of charming.
After he blocks the kid over the fence, the ref throws a flag and the refs are standing there and they say, what's the penalty? And the other ref just goes, I don't know, excessive blocking. And I thought that was great, the way he delivered the line. And then the coach says, where were you taking him, Michael? And Michael Orr just says, to the bus. It was time for him to go home. Just like, all right, this is great. So I really enjoyed that scene. He does so well in that scene, that game, that SJ puts together a highlight video, and he helps out by sending, like, he puts this DVD together because they really need to get him in front of coaches, right? So then we get to, we cut to an office, and it is, I forget what the guy's name is, but Tom Lemming. Tom Lemming is like the recruiting guy, a recruiting analyst, and it's actual Tom Lemming. And his secretary, because they're cutting to the scene, so they just have, apparently they think they just have to have dialogue, but it's just, Coach Saban wants his monthly recruiting updates FedExed. Just like some completely throwaway thing to establish that this guy is the recruiting guy.
I did enjoy that Saban was at LSU, and then they comment that he's going to the NFL. And
yeah, so
didn't do that.
So then the boys are coming to town. We got Nick Saban. We got Houston Nutt. We got Lou Holtz. We got former Auburn coach, current U.S. Senator Tommy Tuberville. We got Philip Fulmer. We got all the fellas are coming into town because they see Michael Orr, and Philip Fulmer, the Tennessee coach, just looks at the film. He sees this block and he just says something like, "I really got to have him." So they all come to town. Philip Fulmer is the only one of those coaches that come to the practice. There's a bunch of assistants because they have to establish. Oh, they also establish early on that they're Ole Miss fans and that Leanne Toohey hates Tennessee. They threw that in there because Philip Fulmer, the Tennessee coach, is really recruiting Michael hard. And they set up a drill at practice because Philip Fulmer says, "Can we do a one-on-one drill?" And Michael Orr sets up against another guy, and obviously Michael Orr runs this guy into the ground. And all the assistants are like, "Wow." And they pull out their cell phones and just start calling people right away to really hammer home that this kid is something. And they also say, Philip Fulmer says something like, "Coach," to the high school coach, like, I've heard about you. I've heard about your program and you're really going places. And in real life, his head coach was Hugh Freeze, who ended up being the head coach at Ole Miss and is currently the head coach at Auburn. So his actual high school coach did go on to be something, which is kind of interesting. So, then we get to the next part, Zach. Everyone wants him, but remember, he's a big dumb oaf and his grades are bad. So we get to the part where we need to get his grades up. And who do we bring in?
Kathy Bates.
This is the other joke. This is where the movie just, I don't know. Like, this is to me like one of the last moments of the movie. And it's a throwaway because Kathy Bates is there and she's just like, I got a secret I gotta tell you.
They're interviewing her, kind of vetting her as a tutor, and she's lets them know she's got this deep thing she's got to tell them, and you think, oh no, is she like a criminal or what's happening? And what does she say, Matt?
"I'm a Democrat." And that's it.
Which you never met one in Memphis, of course. That would be so shocking.
And it's just another one where it's like another joke that's written like a joke, has a cadence of a joke. But it's AI. What was that?
Just my phone all of a sudden went off.
Nice. Accidentally. So, I mean, then it's that, like, the big controversy is he picks Ole Miss, but then they're scared that he picked Ole Miss because he was coerced into picking it by the Toohey's, which, looking back on it, is kind of funny and relevant with the recent news. Like,
this is important that this scene happened in the movie because it does play to this, right? The NCAA gets involved to try to ascertain, did the Toohey's push, you know, do they just like pick you up off the street and push you into going to Ole Miss? And, you know, he gets like interrogated by somebody from the NCAA. There's this sort of all is lost bust up between him and the Toohey's, and he wonders, has it all been a setup? The Toohey's kind of, you know, have this moment of clarity and they realize, oh, you know, we've been pushing him to this. So they go ask, "Do you even want to play football? Why don't you go to Tennessee?" The other big line is when Leanne Toohey says she'd support him at Tennessee, but she won't wear that gaudy orange.
Mm-hmm. It's not in her color.
That was a big one at the time. Going to OU, that was important because, like, obviously our rival was University of Texas. And then we had the in-state game with Oklahoma State. So orange was always, you know, an unpopular color. So, you know, that was all funny. And he thinks about it. And then the big moment, I don't know if you saw this one coming, where after he thinks about it and, you know, they've done all this stuff, when they're like, "Why do you want to go to Ole Miss?" And he's like, "Because it's where my family goes." And that's about the Toohey's. I felt that line coming. I don't know if you also felt that happening.
No, I actually didn't. I didn't, like, yeah. So they, so what do you, so he, it just like to really hammer home that it's his family now.
Yeah. So, and that really kind of intersects with the big controversy now. So that was the movie. It's worth a watch. It's not, I had to watch it on like
the
TV.
The other line, TNT. That's where I watched it too. The other line, Zach, right before was he asks Leanne Tui, was this for you or was this for me? Which I thought was another interesting line now, like looking back on all of it. Like that's
good catch.
The ending is pure just old Miss stuff. So it really wraps up after that and it doesn't touch on his NFL stuff. But the way it ended as like them questioning whether or not the Tuis put him up to this and then him wondering, is this all just a part of their plan to get me to Ole Miss, is like a perfect way to segue into 2023 Michael Orr now.
Yeah. So that's the movie again. I at the end of the day, I still think it's kind of a feel good movie. Like I, there's the problems we talked about with it and the cheese ball stuff, but it's a great performance by Sandra Bullock. I really like anything with Tim McGraw.
Yeah.
And you know, it's fun. It's fun seeing Houston Nutt and their, you know, the Arkansas Razorbacks and that kind of stuff. Like, it's fine. I get why. And it people liked it. Since then, people have said, oh, it's white savior stuff. And it's sort of been reevaluated. But it was a huge hit. And
I
think they said 300 million gross. Sandra Bullock won Best Actress.
I can look that up, what it grossed. But it is a feel-good movie. It's just kind of rough just because the main character is the secondary character. And if... it's just once it all gets kind of blown up when you realize
it's at his expense. Like the problem is, I think it's not to me necessarily the whole white savior narrative. Other people can talk on that. But like an aspect of it is it was at his expense because they made him dumb and they portrayed him as not having a role in any of this and just sort of being plucked out of obscurity and then, you know, plopped into things. And like you said, getting extracted by balloons and having to have salt shakers used to teach him how football works. Like that's the problem with the movie. It doesn't make it unwatchable though. So,
oh no, it's definitely, I mean, set aside all that stuff. You're right. It does feel like a spiritual successor to a Friday Night Lights type of thing. It grossed $309 million on a $30 million budget. So,
that's
total
impressive.
Success. Yeah.
So since then, so Michael played college football at Ole Miss. We obviously wish he would get into the old Mass, but he got into Ole Miss instead.
Good one.
And played college football there. What's his trajectory after that?
He gets drafted in the first round. So they show it in the movie, him getting drafted in the first round by the Baltimore Ravens. He was on the Super Bowl winning team with the Ravens a few years after he got drafted. And his rookie year, he made all rookie team. So he played 8 years.
What was the timeline of when he started in the NFL?
2009 to 2016. So he played for 5 years with the Ravens, 1 year with the Tennessee Titans, and a couple of years for the Carolina Panthers. So he had 8 years.
That's an interesting trajectory because so if it was right around the time that he starts playing for the NFL, the movie was a 2009 movie. And again, Michael from the beginning did not like his portrayal in the film for obvious reasons. And that is understood to have started this sort of breakdown between him and the Tui family.
Right. So he basically comes into the NFL. Like, when did this movie get, it got released on November 20th, 2009. So he signed a contract. He signed his rookie contract on July 30th. So he was 2 months into his actual NFL career. So he's trying to make his way as a rookie. And now he has all this going on, which couldn't have been super great having to juggle both of those.
I mean, being famous is sometimes nice, but right. It was a lot. So, but the movie gets remembered very fondly. Like we said, it was much later that it got kind of reevaluated as far in terms of the white savior characteristics and stuff from it. Michael released a memoir. He played for the NFL. And then what's happened recently is he's saying now, okay, in 2003, what he became aware of was that the papers and the things that were signed to make him part of the Tui family was a conservatorship. mm-hmm. and it didn't establish any kind of official familial relationship. And he believes that they basically tricked him into signing it on the basis of this makes you part of the family. And at the time, they did have a really strong relationship. So, you know, he wanted to be part of the family and it understood they did too. He's 18 years old. So in his memoir, the first one, I Beat the Odds, he talks about it. He mentions multiple places that they're his conservators, but also says that it's the alternative to adoption if you're 18 or over. Well, I looked into it and that's not true in Tennessee. You can adopt an adult. If they're over 21, when you adopt them, it has different implications in your estate planning. You can often with your estate say, you know, I leave this to my children. And if you've adopted somebody above the age of 21, you have to name them specifically. But otherwise, you can adopt an 18-year-old. You can, you know, you don't have to do, you know, a conservatorship is also called a guardianship. And it does put you kind of over someone and you can make medical decisions for them and whatnot.
Right.
And we mentioned before, there's two types of conservatorship. There's conservatorship of the person and conservator of the estate. They were conservator of the person, so they could help with medical and personal things. They didn't actually have, at least per the conservatorship, control of his money. If there was some other arrangement in place, a power of attorney or something, or if they were his business managers, it's totally possible. Mm-hmm. But they don't have the kind of conservatorship that controls all of your money. The Brittany conservatorship that most people know about was both the conservatorship of the person as well as conservatorship of the estate. Well, so,
or Michael Orr filed part of his lawsuit alleged that they had legal authority to make business deals in his name.
So yeah, a lot of this is going to get teased out in the lawsuit and it could really go several ways. I mean, so the basic narrative that they tricked him into this arrangement so that now they're in charge and they can make money off of him, enter business deals, you know, you can charge things to the conservator for the, you know, your time managing it. And if that was happening, that's bad. I mean, and something I pointed out and I asked some people if they could like try to get the TikTok investigators involved is, so the Tuohy family lives in Tennessee. This all plays out there. The management company that worked for Brittany during her conservatorship, TriStar Sports and Entertainment, in all of the sort of Free Brittany lore, they're like the villains. And it's alleged that they loaned money to Brittany's dad to cover the cost of getting her put under the conservatorship. And then as soon as she was under it, they were hired as the managers. There's stories about them linking up with Dina Lohan to get Lindsay Lohan under a conservatorship before she fled to Dubai. And what I want to know, so TriStar, actually their offices were in Tennessee until they became Hollywood. And I think Nashville, not Memphis, but yeah. I want to know, and they got their start managing professional athletes, not singers and actresses. And so, Okay, was there any interfacing between these two parties? Like, I don't know. I couldn't find anything linking Michael or the Tuohys to either TriStar Entertainment or Lou Taylor, but it would be interesting and to know if this business model of getting a talented person under a conservatorship so that you can maximize profits with their likeness, if it actually started there. And then, you know, the pre-launch was Michael Orr and then the real launch was Brittany. It would just be interesting to know. Seems far-fetched, but you know, it's kind of random that they were started out managing athletes in Tennessee. So this all happens and it could just go a couple ways. I mean, maybe, you know, adoptions do take a lot of time and a conservatorship doesn't. And if there were reports that the NCAA was who was requesting that he be in some sort of official arrangement with the Tuohys, maybe, you know, in order for him to start the season, they needed to do a conservatorship because you can do that in a few weeks and adoption takes much longer. In his book, he talks about going to court for the conservatorship, talks about his mom was there and, you know, there were people asking, is this all just to entice him? I mean, that question was asked at the time. Now, I don't know if it was ever explained to him, this is a conservatorship, but I don't know if it was explained to the Tuohy. I mean, you know, that's the thing. I don't think you can actually jump to conclusions about that, the nature of that, but I think some red flags are that they didn't actually have to do a conservatorship. They could have adopted him at 18 years old and that would have made him part of the family. Now the talk about how the conservatorship didn't actually make him part, it's tricky because what does that mean? what does it mean to officially be part of someone's family? I mean, you know, like Leanne refers to him as her son. She did before, she does now on her Instagram, you know, mother of three. And, you know, does the piece of paper drastically change that? I mean, I definitely think from the passage in his memoir, it did to him. So
sure,
that maybe is relevant, finding out
Like mentally being adopted is different than like just being a people who handle your business dealings. Like that's, am I part of the family or am I just like business adjacent?
Right. So the other thing is that what I think was shocking to learn is that the conservatorship is still in place, which is wild. I mean, we're talking.
Yeah. Cause he's 37. Years?
Yeah. He's 37. And this was when he was starting college football. And a conservatorship is supposed to be for somebody who's unable to manage their affairs. So it's really questionable why the courts allowed it to be done if it was really done to basically placate the NCAA rules. That's not a valid usage of something like that. And I mean, if somebody's under a conservatorship, it is the court saying, you know, our attorneys out there can correct us, but my understanding is it is the court saying that they are not able to manage for themselves. And so if that court appointed conservator dies, that person is still a ward and is still in need of a conservator and could have just anybody appointed. So it's really risky to be having people under conservatorships and not be needed. And then the question of, well, is it needed? Is no. The Tui family has already said that they would release him from the conservatorship. They're happy to do so. Well, what changed? What changed since the story broke that now suddenly he doesn't need it? So I would say it's not that relevant what the Tui's intentions were, because they could have had the best of intentions and they may have done right by him all throughout, but they should not have had him still under a conservatorship. That's such a huge mistake. It, you know, even if everybody was acting above board just for their own sake, like they should have been smarter on this, and this blowing up for them is going to be a result of that. And so I don't know who was advising them on this, but you should not have a conservatorship over somebody who doesn't need one, especially if, like they say, their relationship has been deteriorating since the movie came out. So that's, you know, that's my take, is we don't necessarily have to know everybody's intentions and what they really wanted. The big problem is that this conservatorship was allowed to go on this long and that there hasn't already been actions to terminate it.
I mean, he's been complaining and not complaining. That sounds like he's in the wrong. Like he's been, his thoughts on how he was portrayed have been, he's been making people aware of that for years. Right. Like, so this is not like a thing he stumbled onto where he's like, hey, did you guys know that this was still happening? And they're like, what? It's the, I don't, you,
yeah.
Has there been
like the any, evidence against,
like,
the
does the
Tui's.
Tui want, do they want to repair their relationship with him? Right.
Right. And it's like the evidence against the Tui's is obviously that they didn't seem to have, like, I don't think they control the movie. Right. I mean, you know, you're closer to movies than me, but like, I don't think that the family that's the subject of a movie, and it really was a movie from a book. So they're actually like, the movie is about the book. It's not about them directly. So they're already, they don't get to be on set like J.K. Rowling style and veto and things, but they never seemed interested in correcting it and making sure that Michael's version of himself was brought to the forefront. And to an extent, you know, he is why they're relevant and known, which isn't a bad thing, but whatever. And then also knowing that they could have adopted him legally. And I don't know what the factors were that would have made that not the decision, but they could have adopted him rather than placing him under a conservatorship in the beginning. Though that plus them leaving it in place are, to me, that's the main issue with them. But I do think on the flip side, there's some questions to ask about Michael Orr's side of the story.
Right.
Because, it was a plot point of the movie that they were taking advantage of him to get him to go play at Ole Miss and stuff. So I don't think that it makes sense to say that that question was never asked at the time. And then he does by name refer to them as his conservators in his memoir from the past. So, but it's possible he didn't know the implications of that, but it's multiple places in his memoir that they're going to be his conservators, and he says next of kin. And I, you know, I don't know how you establish legal next of kin if there's not a blood relationship. That could have been, you know, the court filings from the time will surely be looked at in all of this, because the other thing I saw was that it was supposed to be terminated by the time he turned 25. Anyway, so from his side,
yeah. No, I finish your thought on that.
Well, the other thing, so to the point that he just became aware of this in 2023, there's kind of two points to that. Is what exactly did he become aware of? Because he knew that he wasn't adopted, and he knew that he was under, that they were his conservators. And if he thought that that was an alternative route to being officially family, and everybody was telling him that and saying, oh, sign the conservatorship, you're part of our family, that's one thing. But on the flip side, you know, is it possible that the lawyer that's working with him has brought this up and kind of interpreted this in the worst light, which you can do with a conservatorship? I mean, you've signed away your personhood in one. So if this was all done because he wasn't be able to play college football, and it was the only thing that could be done in time for the season, and there weren't any problems happening, so it was just left in place, whatever problems there are with that situation, it didn't necessarily mean there was something sinister. And is that, you know, is that part of it? Like, is, you know, I mean, if you found out that people had told you that you were part of their family, but actually they like control your life now, mm-hmm. and that's how it had always been, that would be sort of shocking. But the other thing that I saw was that with the movie, the Tuohys and Michael Orr didn't make much from it, which makes sense. They weren't in it. And again, they were really, I mean, if you get technical about it, they were characters in the book that it was about. And the most of what I've seen said that the only money they got from it was the writer, Michael Lewis, gave them half of his share of the royalties, which they distributed among the family. But then that Michael wouldn't cash his checks from the movie, which probably speaks to how he didn't like it. And so the Tuohys placed it in a trust for his children, I think. But that's something that needs to be looked at, because he's asked for a detailed accounting of everything that's happened since then, which absolutely needs to happen, obviously. The other thing, though, is he has his second book out this month. And like, because that's where you're like, what changed in 2023? And it's like, well, you have a book coming out, you know? And I've always thought the tell-all books are kind of a red flag that something's not going well with somebody, that, you know, I mean, I don't think that the desire to tell all is a healthy thing. So usually, so like what, cause I was looking when I saw a second book, I was like, well, when did that come out? This month, literally. So, you know, that does make you wonder. I mean, again, he could have been cheated and treated awful and still have a book coming out. So I'm not ruling on that, but I don't think it's as cut and dry as much as you see this. It's like an SEC booster family, which seems like the type of people that would like purchase a child off the street to play for their favorite team. And like, I mean, SEC fans are the most insane people. And then you add money. And so, I mean, like that totally, like I could believe either way, but there's just things about it that I think the courts will have to work out. And, you know, there needs to be a detailed accounting of all the decisions that they made at his conservators, as his conservators.
It really, even regardless of Michael Orr's intentions or state of mind, there should be, just for the sake of like, no one should get away with anything under conservatorships, right? So,
no, and that, I mean, that's another thing that Tennessee, that's a big problem too, is whatever the outcome of this case, they did not appoint the, there's a legal term that I don't even remember, but there's in a conservatorship, there is supposed to be a neutral party that's just kind of poking around periodically. And there are supposed to be hearings on whether or not the conservatorship could continue. And there needs to be some kind of conservatorship reform. I mean, everywhere, but especially in Tennessee, if you can put somebody in a lifelong conservatorship without proving any kind of medical or other disability, only on the basis of some contractual need for the NCAA, and then not even have oversight, you know? I mean, what, imagine how many people who aren't NFL players, who aren't successful and talented and have access to resource and have the ability to, you know, speak directly to the public if they're not being heard, how many other people in Tennessee are under this stuff? You know, we don't know, but it would be, I mean, I guess I hope this is the only one, but it would be shocking if this happened and this was the only time that Tennessee just issued a conservatorship without any documented medical or mental need, and then didn't follow up and just let it ride for however long. But it was a red flag to me when the Tui family said they'd happily let him out of it. Because was it necessary or not? You know, mm-hmm. what's changed in a month?
It's interesting. From my experience, fairly close experience, I've been around people who've had a movie made about their lives, and mm-hmm. I don't know what the blind side, what they worked into it, but I know that this movie made about someone's life, this person had extremely close contact with the script and had like a lot of say into what went into it, and it shows. And you can, if it's a story about your, like you said, it's based off a Michael Lewis book, so it might be a little different, but it's still these people's lives. So I think,
not to be confused with Mike Lewis of the blog Where Peter Is. This is right. This is somebody else.
This is Michael.
Michael Lewis. Right.
So I don't know what was written in. They should probably reevaluate how they do business based on that. The other thing is, this is a movie with a $29 million budget. So these people didn't get a lot of money up front. But if they somehow worked into back-end profits, it still would, still would only be, it's like $3 million. Like, it's not tens of millions, right? So it's obviously a lot of money. And I wouldn't even think that it would be $3 million. I think it would, I'm not sure.
Of the gross, of the $309 million that the movie grossed, understand that probably $120 million of that went straight to AMC. Like, there's a lot of people who get paid before you even get to the actual
their cut would be
and
like,
directors and writers, and these people weren't any of those things.
Their cut would be like single percentages, like 1-2%.
Yeah. You don't have to purchase the life rights of someone to do a movie about them.
Right.
A lot of times the studios will, just to prevent any sort of lawsuits, because even whether or not you're going to win or lose, you really just don't want the lawsuit.
Yeah.
And I mean, what I think would be devastating if I was Michael Orr would be to find out that there was a certain amount of consultation given to the Tuis, and right. they didn't speak up about his portrayal, and maybe they corrected this or that about themselves. But nobody cared to correct.
Yeah, that would that be never that would bad, be or that he couldn't real speak. Bad. That would be like really bad.
I would hit those people up for $15 million just over that, just out of pettiness, and just looking at the signs that people are very against conservatorships right now. And I totally would do that just on that basis alone, because I'd be pissed.
I don't. Yeah. So not knowing like literally anything about the contract deals, it seems like the Tuis somewhere played this wrong, and they like it. It very well could have just been like, ooh, someone wants to write a book about us, and someone wants to write a movie about us. And the best way, the best way to get a mom and dad to agree to let them do this, hey, Sandra Bullock's playing you and Tim McGraw is playing you. And that's that is a pretty good way to lock and load this thing and to kind of let them do whatever they want. So, and it's Sandra Bullock up there getting an Oscar, and they show Leanne Tui on the Oscar ceremony, right? It's not Michael Orr's character, and they're not showing Michael Orr. So
the movie wasn't about him. And to me, that's not a problem at the end of the day to do a movie about Leanne Tui. It does need to be acknowledged, though, that Leanne Tui only exists because of Michael Orr, and there would only be any reason to do a movie about her because of him. And, you know, that's where
you could just see, but that you could see where the seeds were planted of just dissension for this, right? Yeah. And if they had no say whatsoever, if they're like, our hands are tied, we can't give any notes, and they aren't bringing us on set at all, and we don't have any feedback whatsoever, then okay. But I would say that that's not even close to the case. Maybe they didn't have final approval, but.
Well, when they didn't have to have any approval, I mean, you know, like they didn't, the movie could have happened without any input from them.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it would be hard to imagine nothing was said or done. And I think that would be mad. I'd, you know, I'd want my $15 million. I think that's what he's hit them up for.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to come out in very nuanced. As much as you, the Tuies just have this natural villain-esque quality as far as what we're looking for in a villain.
Right.
Like, yeah. Again, white, Christian, Southern family, you know,
takes in the Karen type
wife. Right. Like, that story writes itself. I don't think that that's probably the reality. They may have gotten overexcited, but I don't think that they enticed him to the conservatorship as a trick of saying, we're going to be your family if you sign this, thinking right. like, oh, great, once he signs this, we're rich. I think that that's a stretch. I definitely think it was a huge mistake on their part that this thing is still in place and there's it no getting around
literally,
that. There's no yeah, excusing it, that. I mean, it's
everybody could have had the best intentions and it just kind of like took a misstep somewhere and became something it shouldn't have. And like I had fun like poking fun at the movie and like talking about it, but at the end of the day, like it doesn't necessarily reflect on the Tuies or the people in that situation at that time, right? Like it could have just been a good family doing a good thing and just, you know.
Yeah, and happen. I'm wary of the tropes that are against that kind of stuff, because it's like the same people when you get talking about abortion and stuff that are like, what are you going to do about all of the people that don't have families or all the children that this or that?
Yeah.
Are you going to take them in? But then if you do, you're a white savior or you're just feeding your own narcissism or whatever. And so it's like, I mean, so I'm kind of not, I'm not just really about that narrative side of it. So, I mean, I do think in general, if somebody is bouncing home to home and you can offer them a stable home and you have their best interests in heart and they're, you know, they seem interested, you're not just snatching them up. I mean, that's obviously a good thing. And I think that the reevaluation of the movie almost tries to obscure that it's still a work of mercy to, you know,
sure,
feed people and take them in. And, you know, I don't think that you can let day-to-day decisions be, you know, impacted by if you're perpetuating some myth or something. Like, you're supposed to help people, even if you helping them, you know, could be seen as problematic because you're this and they're that. Like, at some point, people are just people.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well.
So, you know, we'll have to follow this story. It'll be interesting to see where it goes. I obviously hope that it's, you know, I mean, I hope that it was not something sinister, not because I couldn't believe that coming out of SEC fans, but I just don't like to see bad things being done to people. So I hope nobody did that to him.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And, you know, we'll see where it goes. And obviously, I hope that Sandra Bullock is happy and healthy somewhere and isn't taking this too hard, you know, not going to somehow give back her Academy Award or some goofy thing.
She played that powerful, strong woman and she deserved it.
It was a great role and it was not a Sandra Bullock. It was not like a lot of her other characters that, you know, there's a little bit of a similarity. If you're seeing, you know, some of her movies, you kind of get pretty similar vibes.
Yeah.
But not from this. This was like a totally different thing for her. And totally, I mean, I guess I have to see the list of who else was nominated, but I have a feeling she absolutely earned her Academy Award in this movie.
Yeah, it was Gabourey Sidibe for Precious, Carey Mulligan in An Education, Helen Mirren in The Last Station, and Meryl Streep in Julia and Julie and Julia.
Oh, well, that was good. I guess Julie and Julia wasn't groundbreaking, and it did make sense as a nomination, but, you know.
When in doubt, throw Meryl Streep in there. All right, well, that's it for me. I did a lot of talk in this episode, so.
Heavily researched episode.
I'm going to have to take
a new podcast.
I'm going to have to take 6 months off to recover.
Yeah. It's like ran out of gas. Yeah. Heavily researched episode. Yeah. But we'll follow this closely and wishing them all the best. And we'll be back with more in the future.
Talk to you soon.
See ya.